Blog Talk Radio.
Not sure if we're on the air or not. I can't really tell. Bobby was not able to get in. He's not showing up. He tried to call in, but I'm not showing. I'm not sure if Jerry's on or not, so I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do a show tonight. So just bear with us if you guys are listening to us out there. Bear with us, and hopefully we'll get whatever our problems are solved. Okay, I think we've got everything figured out now. I'm back on the line. With Bobby and Jerry will call back in. My internet connection crashed, and so it wasn't allowing me to do anything. So we are back on the air. So Bobby and Jerry, if you guys are listening, give me a call. In the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and take a break and run a commercial ad real quick, and hopefully we'll get them on the air.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? that happened in Columbus on my birthday. Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
This is Miss Rachel from The Empire, formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling. Every Friday night, The Empire presents the best in professional wrestling at the Academy Theater in Avondale State. We're also at the Masquerade every month or so. Check us out on Facebook. Just look for Platinum Championship Wrestling, and you'll get the latest details on all the hottest action from The Empire,
formerly known as Platinum Championship Wrestling.
We get it. That's every Friday night at the Academy Theater and at the Masquerade as well every month. We'll see you there.
All right, well, after a couple minutes of technical difficulties, I think I've got everything straightened out. We got Bobby on the line with us. Bobby, reach over and nudge your wife, tell her to call Jerry and tell him to call in.
I heard that.
Oh. My internet, right as we were hitting air, I figured you guys were pulling a rib on me. It went all the way down and we started the show. And neither one of you guys popped up on the screen, and I thought, well, they're just ribbing me. So then I went to play our intro music, and it did nothing. So after fooling around with it and figured out what it was, my internet connection crashes. But when my internet crashes on my computer, it doesn't tell me. It leaves me connected, but it just kills everything.
Oh, okay.
It's not live, so. But anyway, hopefully Jerry will call back in here in a few minutes. He had tried to call in, and one of the times I was back and forth trying to get everything going, and I couldn't connect him quick enough, and so he dropped off. So he's cussing us right now.
Okay. Well, yeah, it was when I would call in, it was just dead. So.
Yeah, that's the way it was with me. He wasn't doing it. He wasn't responding to anything. Wouldn't play our intro. It wouldn't do anything. So hopefully those that are listening to us or those that will listen to the archives will hang in long enough to realize we've got everything straightened out, at least so far, and we'll have a show tonight. I guess the big news for this week is an unfortunate passing. Somebody who it was truly a legend. I know the legend word is thrown around quite loosely in the wrestling business, but the gentleman I'm speaking of was definitely a legend. And that for those of us that knew him as Joe Scarpa, and the people who only are familiar with him from his work in New York as Chief J. Strongbow, what a talented worker he was. He was just something else.
Absolute pleasure to be in the ring with. He was a class act, and he was very hard to get to know him. He was all business, and he was strictly business, and everything else came after that. And he a lot of people didn't like that, but that's probably the attitude most of us should have had, and. He did very well in the wrestling business. He did very well as Joe Scarpa. He did very well as Chief J. Strongbow.
I mean, if you think about it, the way he was is probably why he lasted. I mean, his active career, he started late 50s, I think 57.
57.
And his final in-ring time was in 83. So that's almost 30 years. I mean, a lot of guys have done that, but if you look at the ones who stayed relatively healthy and had that long a career is because of just what you said. They kept to themselves. They didn't go into the wild partying and the, you know, the living, the lifestyle. I mean, he had he lived at that in Griffin there and for close to 50 years. So, you know, he,
Joe made Ted Allen look like a big spender. he was very frugal. And you know, I look back at my life and I look back at my career. Man, I wish I had a man.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't live the lavish lifestyle, but I just never, you know, I mean, I'm like everybody else. Well, this is never going to end, you know.
Right.
We're going to be joined, hopefully, about 8:45 by a gentleman named Tom Stevenson. Tom was probably one of the individuals outside of the wrestling business that got as close or was as close a personal friend of Joe Scarpa as anybody in the world. And he spent a lot of time at his home. He spent a lot of time traveling with him up and down the roads a little bit, and they played golf together. And Joe imparted a lot of knowledge to Tom over the years. And Scarpa had a nickname for everybody, and of course Tom spent a lot of years in the tire business, and a lot of times he wouldn't even refer to Tom as by his last name. He was Tire Tom. So, but Tom swapped some emails with him. Hopefully Tom's going to call in about 8:45, and he'll share some stories with us. Like I say, he can share some insight into the man, Joe Scarpa. A lot of us knew him as the wrestler, but I was not that close to him. We were acquaintances, as Joe would put it. But what a pleasure he was to be in the ring with, man. He was the first, as a kid, he was the first babyface that I ever saw the first feud I remember was him and Stan Stasiak. This would have been in the 60s in Georgia. And it was the first time I ever, it was a, the first loser leave town match I ever saw was him and Stasiak. And just part of my blessed life, I grew up to be able to be in the ring with both those guys. And what gentlemen they were.
Well, they worked quite a bit together in New York, too, after Bumper became Strongbow. Of course, Stasiak was a top heel up there in the early 70s, which is when started there. A lot of people don't realize how long a career he had prior to becoming Strongbow. I mean, he was in his early 40s when he became Jay Strongbow.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, he started in 57, one of the very first territories that he really got over in was the Mobile territory. He was the Gulf Coast champion in 1960. From there, you know, he was a big star in Los Angeles. He worked up in New York for Vince Sr. as Joe Scarpa in the early 60s. But I think the two territories that he was really rooted in and best known for under the Joe Scarpa name was Florida and Georgia.
Yeah.
He was in Florida probably starting around 63, 64, something like that, and was a mainstay there until I think he came to Georgia in 68 or 69 and worked on top of both territories, was a big star on both territories. Total different wrestler, though, from what he was when became Chuck. He had some of the same mannerisms, but, you know, a lot of people couldn't believe. Of course, a lot of people didn't see him until, you know, the more modern era, the early 80s. When you know he had gotten quite a bit heavier, and obviously was a lot older. He was probably in his early to mid 50s at that point, and he was mainly a tag wrestler and everything. So a lot of people don't understand that how good he was prior to that. But for he was a fairly large guy. He was, you know, well over 6 feet tall. Probably the peak of his career was probably 240, 245, something like that, but was very agile and was a good mat wrestler, could brawl, could do it all. But he said that when he became Strongbow, so for many people didn't realize and didn't put the two together unless, you know, you really knew who Joe Scarpa was and was really, you know, familiar with the wrestling. Of course, it was easier to do back in those days because outside of wrestling publications and the rare, you know, this was pre-cable days, the rare Florida tapes that would end up in New York or the California tapes that end up, you know, on a public access station somewhere in another state. You really didn't see, you know, guys all the time like you do now or did during the height of the cable day. But, and that, you know, he was probably, I would say, probably the most successful that ever did that. And what I mean by that, I mean having one full career, then, you know, having another full career to extend that one under a total different persona. I mean, a lot of guys work under different names. A lot of guys would use a name here in this territory, use a name here in this territory, but they didn't change up their looks unless you count adding a mask. And even that to the degree was not, in my opinion, not exactly the same because it's easier to be a different personality under a mask. But the only other person I can think of that was that successful doing that was Mike McCourt becoming Austin Idol.
Yep.
As far as the overall change of everything. And even then, Mike McCourt is Mike McCourt was nowhere near as big a star as Joe Scarpa was. So that just tells you how difficult that is once to pull off.
I was in the ring with Mike McCourt untold times. And after the plane crash, and of course he came back here and he worked in Georgia for a while as Mike McCourt, and then he disappeared. And the next time I saw him, he was Austin Idol, and I had no clue who he was. I mean, I've never seen a person change that much. I mean, he lost a ton of weight.
Yeah.
You know, bulked up. I mean, he's always a power lifter, but he actually redefined his body and just absolutely, I mean, it was just his mannerisms were even different.
And, you know, you've got somebody else that did similar to that, but kind of eased his way into it. Buddy Colt, prior to being Buddy Colt, of course, with the baby face, is Cowboy Ron Reed.
Ron Reed, yeah.
But then he went with the blonde hair and was handsome Ronnie Reed and had basically the same persona as he eventually would with Buddy Colt. And in talking about mask wrestlers, the most successful, I think, there's three that really pulled that off real well. Wrestling, too, would have to be the most successful. I mean, he was a big star as Johnny Walker in Tennessee and in Florida.
Right.
You know, various other places. And then I guess his career was almost at a complete end when he became Wrestling, too, and he added another 10, 15 years onto his career.
Oh, at least. Well, it actually started before the wrestling, too, when he became the grappler down in Florida.
That's true. But he had unmasked his grappler, though, and was back using the Johnny Walker.
Yeah, name. Yeah. But the wrestling, too, thing, he kind of backed into that because Timmy Woods was such a big star here. And I say he backed into it. I mean, him and Timmy had been partners and friends for years, but it just... he got over. I mean, he was absolutely unreal. And there was a time here, you know, in the 70s, and all you had to do was put a poster out with Wrestling 2 on it, and you were going to draw a couple of $1,000.
Yeah.
I mean, he was that over.
Well, I mean, you got to figure that he was that over because, you know, there were other Wrestling 2s that popped up. Don Green used it in Tennessee. With Wrestling 2 in Tennessee, and of course the infamous Joe Powell thing in Georgia, and the same thing happened with Mr. Wrestling. I mean, Tim Woods made such a hit with that gimmick that you know, Dick Steinborn did it, Gordon Nelson did it, Francisco Flores did it, Ron Starr did it. I mean, there were Mr. Wrestlings all over the place, but you know. There was none as good, obviously, as Tim Woods. And another person, kind of a lesser known, but unless you grew up in the Gulf Coast territory, Leon Baxter was the same way. He had been around as Leon Baxter. He was a fairly well-known journeyman. He'd worked in Georgia. He'd worked in the Carolinas. He'd worked in Oklahoma. probably a bigger star in Oklahoma than anywhere else because of the matches that he had with Danny Hodge. But then when he came back to the Mobile territory, and I say came back because he was originally from Dothan, grew up in Dothan. When he came back there and started his working for the Houston County Sheriff's Department, that allowed him to, because Mobile was such a small territory as far as the trips went, that allowed him to work, you know, a day job and still wrestle at night. And, but of course, to hide his identity of being a sheriff's deputy, he put on the mask. And that, again, there, he did that, and he started in 1970, added another 10 years to his career of becoming the wrestling pro. And, you know, like I said, a lot of guys along the line would work without a mask, put a mask on, go somewhere else, work without a mask again. But in thinking about Two and Baxter, once they put on the mask, that was it. You know, they never took it off again.
Yeah.
And another one that kind of falls in that category, but he actually added a third persona, was Bill Eady. Of course, he was one of the Mongols early in his career. And then literally overnight became the mass superstar. He was in the Crockett territory and worked one night as Bolo Mongol, and the next night he was a superstar and never looked back. And that had to have been hard to do. Totally change your the way you worked and everything else because you have how talented he was.
Well, not nearly the success factor with the second one, but Jody Hamilton did. He was the assassin for, well, he started out as one of the Hamilton brothers, and him and his brother Larry, and then of course they developed their own thing with the Missouri Mauler, with Larry and the assassins with Jody. But late in Jody's career, he became the Flame. And I don't, you know, well, like I say, he gained nowhere near the notoriety of the assassin team was, but he did it with the Flame to some degree.
Right. Well, Jerry just tried to call me on my phone. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take another quick commercial break while I'm trying to give him
okay.
a call. And I can't see the call in, so bear with me.
All right.
Georgia wrestling fans, you're going to want to make your plans to be at Johnny G's the first, third, and fifth Sunday of every month, 2 p.m. bell time, for Rampage Pro Wrestling television taping. And fans, if you're in Middle Georgia, make sure that you watch Rampage Pro Wrestling on Fox 24, Saturday 9 a.m. on the My 41.2, Saturday at 10 p.m. Cox Communications Cable, Thursday 8, Saturday at noon, and of course, Rampage Rewind, the one-half-hour show on Cox Communications throughout the schedule. Fans, be there.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Red Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular?
Over to trying to make sure I caught you. You with us this time?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Man, I was there before 8 o'clock.
I went to the Bill Watts School, and since you wasn't here when we started, you're fine, so I'll tell you where to send the check.
Y'all are low down, man. I told my wife, I said, they called it off.
No, that was my computer crashed. Just as we were going on air, and I never even saw you and Bobby. You never even popped up on my screen. My screen completely froze.
Sure
so
it did.
I had to go, you know.
That's about the lowest down trick ever. I sent you an email. I said, man, the show been called over. What?
No,
man.
I was cussing YouTube before. We called on the air because it said show will start in 5 seconds, and I didn't see either one of them. Then I figured something was wrong when I couldn't play the intro. But anyway.
How long y'all been on?
Oh, my. We've been on since about 20 minutes. About 20 minutes. I was just trying to figure out how to call you to tell you we were on when I saw you pop up on here. So.
I called you on your phone. It's just not taking any call from wrestlers, so I hung up.
Well, we've been, of course, discussing Jay Strongbow, Joe Scarpa, in his passing on Tuesday, and the and guys that had two complete careers basically under two different personas. And Bobby and I both think that he probably was the most successful at it because he was very successful as Scarpa, a big star as Scarpa, and then totally changed around to become Dick Strongbow and was you know, just as big or even bigger a star under that persona. Did you work with him?
No, but I met him as a kid, and I was on a lot of cards with him, and he, let me tell you, y'all probably already discussed this. There wasn't a nicer guy and knew more about this business than Joe Scarpa.
Exactly right.
He was, I mean, he was just, he was a fantastic guy. He was so knowledgeable about this business.
Did either one of you know what his background was?
No.
Somebody told me the other day he started in Tennessee. And I can't remember who was telling me this, but they said something to the effect that Ronnie West knew him before he was actually in the business or something up there. I don't know.
No, that was me telling you.
Oh, that was you. Okay.
Ronnie couldn't have known him because he started in the business in 1947.
No, 57.
That's not what it said when I looked it up.
Really?
Yeah, I
looked it up. It wouldn't surprise me that Hampton that far back, because I know, no, what I was telling Bobby was Ronnie knew him before Ronnie was in the business.
Okay, I got it backwards then. Well, that was, yeah, he.
Go ahead, Bobby.
Well, he was 84.
He was 83.
Or, well, 83, he would have been 84 this year. So, you know, 47 is not too far-fetched.
No, that's what it said.
Goodness.
I know when WWE was in Columbus and Ricky Hunter was working for him, he stopped by my gym. He said, "The chief wants to see you tonight." I said, "Yeah, I'm going to come down." And I said, "I'd like to see him." He's about the only one I want to see besides him and Ricky. So I went down there, and the chief said, "You bring your stuff?" I said, "Joe, I didn't bring my stuff." He said, "Go home and get your stuff." I said, "Man, I don't want to wrestle tonight." He said, "We're short a guy." So I went and got home and got my stuff and come back and put my boots on. He said, "You're on fourth." I said, "All right." He said, "I want to get Mike Sharp's hand raised." I was lacing my boots and looked up at him. He said, I'm just kidding. I wasn't going for that in Columbus and doing them a favor.
Did he take
but
care
he was,
of you?
He was a, he, I mean, I used to run, be with him up in Detroit a lot. He was, I mean, and the second time they come back through, he said, "This is Joe's exact words." He said, "This is a carnival, man." He said, "I'm just playing the game." He said, "We do the same show every night." You know, that's when they was really on the road, you know, every night, you know.
Yeah.
He just, because he's making money and, you know.
We talked about that. But I was telling him, he made Ted Allen look like a big spender. I mean, he was very frugal, very frugal.
Very. Very,
but
very. And he was smart by doing that.
It paid off. I told Michael, I said, "I wish I'd have been the same way."
Well, Bobby, did you ever go see him in Griffin?
Never did.
You know, I didn't either. I didn't either.
Last time I saw Joe was at, I guess it was in Macon when we did the little deal down there for two. That was the last time I saw him.
Was he there?
Yes.
I don't remember him being there.
Yes, he was. I got some pictures with him and Rocket together.
Well, I was there.
Yep. Because that was the first night I met Bo.
Well, I just don't remember Joe Scarpa being there, because I got pictures from that, and I don't know why I didn't have a picture of him.
Yep, he was there.
Well, isn't that strange?
I never worked with him. He was by the time I got in the business, he was winding his career down and was strictly working for Vince Sr. and then Vince Jr. But my favorite Joe Scarpa story, and I have to get Bobby to tell it because he knows it better than I do, is at the moment. It's actually a Chick Donovan story, but Scarpa figures into it.
Oh, God, that was on the golf course. They were, you know, Joe was a big golfer, and they were on. He was on a golf course somewhere, and Chick Donovan was playing golf. And,
oh,
you know,
Lord.
Chick's got that long blonde hair, and you know how he dresses and so forth. And Joe was just looking at him. And they say Chick walked over to him, and this was told to me, so I'm assuming it's true. It sounds logical. So Chick walked over to him and said, "I can't help but you notice, keep staring at me." He said, "You might know me." He said, "My name's Chick Donovan." He said, "I'm an international wrestling star." And Scarpa said, "No, I've never heard of you." He said, "Perhaps you've heard of me. My name's Joe Scarpa."
Well, our problems continue. Jerry just dropped off, so he missed the punchline. So the story was that bad he hung up on us.
I heard that.
Oh, man.
I missed that
because my phone did something.
You don't like my story? You just hang up on us? I mean, please.
My phone didn't like it or something. I missed it.
Anyway, Chick Donovan walked over to Scarpa. Scarpa was just looking at him. And he told Scarpa, he says, "I can't help but notice you staring at me. You might know me. My name is Chick Donovan. I'm an international wrestling star."
I believe he would say that.
And Scarpa looked at him and said, "No, never heard of you." He said, "Maybe you've heard of me. My name's Joe Scarpa."
That was Joe.
I was trying to think, you know, I mean, you think of these stories. We were in Carrollton one night, and he was working with somebody, and I don't know who it was. But we were working a return where we were going to disqualify the Indian. He was going to go on the war path and do the whole. Somehow or another, he got a garbage can in the ring, and he hit me with a garbage can. And of course, I got to bleeding, and it was just one of those nights where it was just right, and it was in my ears and in my eyes, and I was just covered. And I just laid down. I wouldn't move. So Scarpa run, whoever he was working with had run. Scarpa looked at me and just gave me that disgusted Indian look, and he left, and I'm laying in the middle of the ring, and I just refused to move. I figured I'd been hit with a garbage can. I should be dead. So you remember Horace that worked over there that was the head of the security for Mr. Butler?
Yes, I do.
He was one of those guys. He was a super nice guy, but he was one of those guys that thought he knew about our business, but he wasn't quite sure. So I just laid there. I wouldn't move. And, you know, old Granny and all of them are around the ring going, "Get up, you ain't hurt." And I just wouldn't move. So finally Horace come in the ring, and he said, "Are you okay?" And I went, "No, Horace, I'm not." I said, "I ain't never been hit that hard in my life." I said, "I just don't think I can walk." I said, "I can have some help." So I practically made him and some other guy tote me to the dressing room. And we get in the dressing room, and Joe's sitting there, and he's mumbling. When he was strong, boy, he had this mumble he'd do. You know, he just incoherent mumble. That was his Indian talk. And I sit down in the chair, and I just was just all bent over. And he got up, and he just started screaming at me, and he kicked the chair. And when he kicked the chair, I just took a bump in the floor, and the chair went flying, and I'm laying in the floor. And Horace actually stepped over me and put his hand on his gun.
I believe
and
that's
what he was. He told Scarpa, he says, "There ain't no need for that. He was just doing his job." And he actually stood there over me till Scarpa took a shower and left. And, of course, Joe knew he was doing it, so he took his sweet time. So I'd have to lay there on the floor. Oh.
Everybody's got, as long as Joe's around, everybody knew him, everybody's got a story. He told me one night, that's when Dusty was really hot in Florida, you know. So they booked him in New York. Madison Square Gardens, they teamed him and Dusty up. He told Dusty, he said, "Before we go out there now," he says, "you're just passing through. I'm staying. Don't try to bury me out there." You know, the dream. Well, he went out there, stayed out there, trying to get over, you know, his first night in New York. Well, the chief had enough. He come in there and cleared the ring. The guy he was in the ring with and the other guy's partner had them all out on the floor, beating the heck out of them. Got back in the ring and told Dusty, he said, "They're all yours." That was the chief.
Oh, I love
looking
it.
Looking out for himself, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I love it.
He was. You knew about his grandson, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
They say he liked to die, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, I told Michael that I've been swapping emails. We got a guy that's going to call us here hopefully in about the next 5 minutes. His name is Tom Stevenson. Tom was never in the wrestling business, but Tom became Joe's friend, and they became very, very, very close. And Ted Allen was best man at Tom's wedding. Tom just is sort of a – he sort of got close to our business by proxy, if you will. But he is – I asked him to call tonight and share some stories about Joe because he probably knows him better than anybody in the world at this point. And we were talking, you know, I was trying to find out some details on a memorial service or something, and Tom sent me an email and he said the chief's already buried. I mean, they like buried him the next day. He said they were so private, and Joe had said, you know, don't want no big deal made out of it. That I mean, it was like just bang bang private service and it was over. So. I understand and respect their privacy. I just hated that those of us that knew him couldn't pay our respects.
Just thinking, Ted Allen being the best man at a wedding, I'm thinking, now, did he actually spring to rent a tuxedo, or was there a funeral home that got broke into the night before?
You'll have to get Tom to tell you the story. He said that he was going through here recently. He was going through the book from his wedding and his reception. He said there was more wrestlers there. He said there was no wrestlers there but Ted. He said, but you wouldn't believe all the wrestlers that signed the book. He said he thinks every time Ted went by there, he wrote somebody's name in it.
Oh, man. Were you, Bobby, I know you were around. I don't know, Jared, you were in Georgia when they worked that angle or not, the deal that he and Ernie Ladd did with the tearing his headdress up.
Yeah, he stuffed them feathers in his mouth on TV.
I don't think I was, no. I don't know when that was, but.
Well, they originally did that deal in New York, didn't they?
Yeah, I don't know if it was Ladd that he did it with. I think he did it in every territory he worked in.
He did it with somebody, but he did it with Ladd in Atlanta, where Ladd tied him into the ropes, and on Atlanta TV he tied him up in the ropes, and he took one of those headdresses and just absolutely tore it to pieces and shoved the feathers in the chief's mouth.
Well, I'm sure Joe made the office pay for that headdress. Wouldn't you think?
I would think so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Well, you said you worked with him up in Detroit, right?
Yeah, I didn't work with him.
But you were in the territory at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, and I've been partners with him and all, but never actually worked against him, no. You know, him and Curtis were together for years.
Don Curtis, yeah, in Florida. Yeah, they were a very well-known team. He and Jose Lothario were also a big team in Florida. That's what we found out before. We were able to get you on the air. The Florida and Georgia were probably the territories he was best known for as Joe Scarpa, even though he worked out of Nashville, he worked in Mobile, he worked in Los Angeles. I think he worked in Texas at one point. But going back to what I was saying about his background, I never was sure where he was from because in Mobile, the Mobile paper always said he was from Los Angeles. He was an ex-former pro football player from Los Angeles. But since he's passed, and Bill Bowman told me this, that he was actually born in Philadelphia. But everywhere in the other territory he ever worked, he worked as the Rebel Joe Scarpa when Bill from Mobile.
Yep, that's what he was here. Jerry, you saw him as a young man, and I saw him as a kid, and you know, and of course, I didn't know what fire was back then, but when he was Joe Scarpa, man, he had that drive. There was something about him that people just wanted to get behind him, and
he sure did.
And he was like Dick in the respect that he knew how to sell. And I mean, you just think he was dead, and then all of a sudden, here he comes.
He knew the business.
Yes,
no
he did.
He knew it. He knew it.
What made him so over in New York is because, as you know, the Strongbow character, he, you know, was so sympathetic because of his selling. And if you go back and look at his career up there, how many, every time they wanted to have a babyface turn heel, how they did it was they had him team in with Strongbow, and he turned on Strongbow. And he was so over up there and had people's sympathy so much, anybody that turned on him automatically became the most hated person up there. They did it with Jimmy Valiant. They did it with Spiros Arion. They did it with Peter Maivia. All three of those turned on Strowman. I think they did it with Victor Rivera. But they all worked that way, you know, as his tag team partner. And then they betrayed him. And, of course, that made him instantly the most hated person up there because, you know, I'm sure people that live in New York or was around and watched that during that era, but I would argue to say that he was probably as over or more over than San Martino was at one point.
He was over. He was there a long time, too.
He was.
A long time.
He went there in 1970 and was there until 83, which is when his active career ended, and then I think he spent another 10 or 12 years working as a road agent for Vince Jr.
He had a long career, and I'm glad he did.
Yeah, he was, there won't be any more like that. I don't think, anyway.
You know, early on, you guys and Bobby and Mike, didn't you think that our careers would have been that long? Working for an office somewhere, you know, promoting a town for the office somewhere, or I really did.
Yeah.
It didn't happen, though, did it?
I never saw it ending. When I started, I thought, this is what I'll do till I die in some shape, form, or fashion.
Exactly. Have to be some part of it.
Yeah.
Goes to show you, doesn't it?
Oh, you just don't ever know.
We still are every Thursday night. So. Let's see. If we go another year and a half, my Thursday night career will last as long as my wrestling career.
But I don't know how it might affect what you're doing now, Mike, but these guys trying to run these little shows now with the gas. That gas is $3.90 down here, man.
Oh, geez, it is up here, too.
Is it really?
I paid $3.95 yesterday when I said that.
I mean, that affects everything. Have y'all seen it, Mike, or y'all haven't got started yet?
I'm sure the circus itself sees it more than I will. Of course, everything that they are on diesel, so diesel's been high, you know, the last several years this way. But, you know, and this one has affected me more so than normal because my towns are so far apart. They're actually 50 miles apart. So, you know, it's affected me because I've been back and forth every other day. I'm in one town one day and another town the next. So it's affected me a little bit more, but it hasn't been too terrible with that. I mean, once you're in a town, for me, usually if I've got more than one town, they're fairly close together. If I've only got one town, once I'm in town, you know, I'm not really going anywhere for a couple of weeks, but except around, you know, the local area. And I'm lucky. My gas mileage isn't nowhere near as good as yours, but I get about, you know, 27 miles per gallon. I've got a large tank on my car. So when I drove up here, I left Bobby's house, and I was already on a quarter of a tank because I had been to Macon and back the day before. Once I had driven up, I had filled up in somewhere in Alabama before I'd gotten to Bobby's. I went to Macon and then back to Bobby's, and I still had a quarter of a tank left when I left to come up here on Monday. I stopped right before I got on 20 in Covington, filled up, and I got up here, still had a quarter of a tank.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm lucky. My car gets ready to gas on a very efficient point. You know, I could have what you've got, but then I'd have to rent a trailer to haul all the stuff I have on. Yours is a hybrid, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It'll do.
No. The way I drive it, I drive it right. I get about 54 in town. And it'll do 48 on the road. I just hate, all the years I put money in gas tanks, I just don't want to do it anymore.
And you just think if you were working in Oklahoma nowadays, if territory
you
was
you just, man, you couldn't do it. I drive the Tybee back every day. I think about getting a goat in a cart.
How far is it to Tybee from your place?
About 12 miles.
I drive 94 a day round trip.
I don't know how you stand it, Bobby.
Well, I'm in the company van 4 days out of five. So it's their gas and not mine. That's the way I stand it.
Now just what if you was footing the bill every day?
I'd have to stay in town some. Me and Debbie's already talked about that. The way gas prices are right now, I'd have to stay in town.
What kind of mileage do you get?
I drive my pickup truck and I get about 20 miles to the gallon. So it's 5 gallons a day if I go round trip. So that's $20 a day, $100 a week, just to go back and forth to work if I had to drive every day.
That adds up, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. Me and Debbie's talked about it. My church is in town. My church is only about 4 miles from my office. And I told her, I said, I have a recliner, I've got a TV, and I have a sofa in my study. I said, if it gets worse or it gets bad, I said, I can stay there at night.
It looks better all the time, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. Plus, I have a little refrigerator in there, too, so I can just, you know, pack some goodies in there and be right there.
I tell you, we're going to have to do what we're going to have to do. I don't see it slowing down for a while.
It don't look like it. It don't look like it. Yeah, you're talking about, you know, I mean, these guys running these shows and stuff now, you know, most of them are running once a week, once a month, or whatever they're doing. Can you imagine just taking a normal week? And now Georgia was basically short trips, but just take Georgia for instance. And, you know, even if you base it on 25 miles a gallon, you know, Monday night from it, and saying you lived in Atlanta, and it's not, with you living in Columbus, it was worse on you a lot of nights than it was everybody else.
A lot worse, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, from Atlanta to Augusta back, that's 300 round trip. You know, Tuesday night making, that's basically 200 round trip, a little less. If you went to Albany, that's 350 round trip. Columbus, 200 round trip. And then on Thursdays, especially when we was doing Macon TV, you had to go to Macon, and then wherever you went that night, Athens or Rome or Savannah or wherever we went, back in my day, I know used to, you went from Augusta to Savannah and spent the night.
Right.
But, you know, Friday night you run Atlanta, but then Saturday you do Atlanta TV and Columbus TV and then go somewhere that night and then back home. I mean, it would kill you. It would absolutely kill you.
Well,
I can't imagine Louisiana or Oklahoma.
You've got a full tanker truck behind you.
Jeez. I remember Bob Griffith, or Bob Griffin, came here. And he came here from the Oklahoma Territory. And this is when McGurk was still running out of Tulsa, running the office out of Tulsa. He came here, and he had an Oldsmobile 98. And he had been here about a week, and I made a trip with him somewhere. And we pulled in the gas station there, and he got out, and he pumped some gas in the tank. And then he popped the trunk, and I thought, what's he doing? So I got out and walked around there. He had about a 100-gallon tank that he had specially built into the back of that 98 so he could fill it up. And he had an electric fuel pump on it so that he said when he was making those trips out in Oklahoma so he didn't have to stop so much, if it ran low, he would just, you know, fill up the tank out of there with his electric fuel pump. And I thought, well, that's kind of an ingenious idea unless you get hit from behind by something.
you know, him hauling all that extra
liquid, that weight and everything. It couldn't be helping the
mileage.
Yeah.
But it was. It was. I've done many a 3,000 a week out there. But that's what it was. So, yeah. But I mean, gas. You didn't think much about the gas, you know. But now, man, please.
Well, now the only way they could make it would be to get a church van and haul 20 people and charge them all $2 a piece a mile.
Well, yeah,
that's what Stu Hart done. I mean, Stu Hart, basically, he ran, the guys didn't travel, you know, individually. He had a 10 or 12 passenger van. He had two of them, one for the heels, one for the baby faces, and that's how they went, you know.
Yeah, I heard they had some trips up there, too.
Oh, I can't imagine. Just the thought of driving on a frozen lake.
Yeah, I would.
Territory right there.
Well, I've heard guys tell some horror stories up there in the wintertime.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't want none of that action.
You know, get back to tell us about that. He and Dennis Hall went up there and worked. Whatever length of time it was, but I just cannot imagine. I mean, because they have roads that exist in the wintertime that don't exist in the summertime because they're all, you know, frozen lakes.
I'm just not going to ride a road like that. I'm sorry. I'm not. Be a heat wave come through while I was on it. I'm not going to go for that. I love the business, but I didn't love it that much.
You have to carry an oar in your car in case you...
Either that or a scuba tank with you. Drive with a scuba tank on and a mask.
Well, you know, we laugh about that, but, you know, I mean, think about all the stupid things we did. And, you know, maybe at times we didn't think they were stupid, or we didn't think about it as being stupid, but you look back on it now and you go, you know, save the grace of the good Lord, we'd be dead.
Think about it. I had my daddy put it to me like this one time. He said he thought Ted and I were crazy for what we were doing. He said, sometimes you go to Waycross, don't you? I said, yes, sir. He said, if I nail $100 bill on a tree in Waycross, would you drive to Columbus and back to go get it? I said, not really. It makes sense, doesn't it?
Well,
if you look at it like that, you wouldn't do it.
Listen, and I've told you this before, but the greatest story I ever heard, and it was told in relation to country music, but it fits our business perfectly. Charlie Louvin told a story about he had to make a trip for a concert out of Nashville on a Saturday night, and he said it was like a 150-mile trip. He said it was snowing, it was cold, he didn't want to go, and he said he called a buddy of his that knew nothing about the music business to go with him and said they drove the 150 miles in the snow and the ice and the rain, and they got there and he set his, you know, his records and things up that he was going to sell that night. He said he goes out and performs, says nobody shows up because the weather's so horrible. The promoter comes in and tells him, look, man, we didn't take in enough money for me to pay you the full amount I promised you with the cash. I'll pay you when we get back to Nashville out of my office, but I just don't have it tonight. He said he loads his stuff up. Him and his buddy stop at the first little 7-Eleven, said they got some adult beverages, and they started back the long trip back to Nashville. And he said the whole trip home, he's knocking the music business to his buddy. And he said they get almost back to Nashville, and the guy, I guess, had heard enough, and he turns to Charlie Louvin, and he goes, why don't you just quit? And Louvin said he slammed on the brakes and slid the car to a stop. And he turned and looked at the guy, and he goes, I can't quit. I'm a star.
There you go.
Does that not describe our business? I mean, I had somebody tell me one time, they asked me what I made, or they asked me something, and I got to thinking about it. Back, and you made this too, when the guarantee was $15, from Atlanta to Savannah was 4.5 hours.
I never worked when it was $15, Bob.
When I started, it was $15 a night. 1972 with Gunkel, it was $15 a night. That was a guarantee.
Well, it was higher than that for the Georgia office.
It was $15, and then it went to 35. 20, did it go 25 or 35? I think it went 25, and then it went 35. And when I quit in 83 for Barnett, it was at 65.
Right.
That's what it was when I worked for the Georgia office. It was 65 for the Georgia office.
Yeah.
And it was before it was 45.
But even at 25 or 35 even, 4.5 hours to Savannah, get there an hour before the show, work 2 hour show. So now you got 7.5 hours invested, 30 minutes to get dressed. You're up to 8 hours, 4.5 hours on, 12.5 hours for $25. If you break that down by how much you made an hour, you could have worked at the gas station and made that.
But you wasn't on TV, Bobby.
Well, I was a star.
I'm give you a quick rundown. When I had my gym, I put on bodybuilding shows for 10 years, and I'd always fly in a professional bodybuilder as a guest poster. Now, I had flown a girl in from Los Angeles, round trip, put her up to Hilton. I put them all up at the Hilton, treated them the way I'd want to be treated. I flew them in from Texas. I flew them in from Arizona. I flew them in from New Jersey. Flew them in from Detroit. There's a bodybuilder in Atlanta, Georgia, named Lee Haney,
mm-hmm.
who was Mr. Olympia at the time.
Yep.
So I give him a call. I said, Lee, this is Jerry Oates. He said, yeah, I know who you are. I said, you know, I got a show coming up in August. And I said, I'm interested in bringing you in as a guest poser. He said, what's the date? And I gave him the date. He said, just a minute, guys, book out. He said, I'm available that day. I said, all right. He was the current Mr. Olympia. I said, all right, Lee. I said, well, what's your fee for coming down to Columbus and posing? He said, $5,000. So I sat there a minute, and I had some sponsors, and I knew I'd sell the place out. And I said, that's the deal. I said, well, that's fine. I said, here's the date, and I said, I'd like you to be here such and such a time. Now, he lives in Atlanta, 90 miles away, right, Bobby, whatever.
Yep.
And as we're getting ready to get off the phone, he hits me with, oh, by the way. I said, what is it? He said, I'm going to need a round-trip air ticket. I said, I tell you what, Lee, I said, let me get back with you. I said, I got to catch another line. I'll be back in touch with you. I never called him again. It wasn't the idea of me buying a plane ticket. Don't get me wrong. I flew Gaspari from New Jersey, Rachel McLeish from Los Angeles. I mean, I bought the tickets, round-trip tickets. You can't drive 90 miles for $5,000 that nobody will ever know about but him and the Lord. Because I paid in cash.
I drove 90 for a lot less.
Me and you, I've driven 700 for a lot less. But, I mean, that was... I may be wrong for doing that. I just when he hit me with that, I'm thinking, you'd be back home by midnight.
Oh, yeah.
You would have to leave your house till 6 o'clock. You're going 6 hours for $5,000? Come on, man.
If you still got his phone number, call him up and say, well, I thought about it, I just can't use you.
I tell you what, I bet you what right now, I bet if I called him and said, I'll give you $5,000 to drive to Savannah, the guest pose, that you're not Mr. Olympia anymore, he'd do it.
What I bet he would do.
You know he'd do it.
Oh. Go ahead, Jerry.
No, I'm just still sick, but that man won't bet $5,000.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Well, we've got a caller from Harrington 706. So hopefully this is Tom, maybe. So let me try and get him on the air. Call from Georgia, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Michael.
Yes.
Tom here. Bobby. Jerry,
hey,
are you
Tom,
guys doing?
Hey, Tom.
How are you?
Fine.
Well, I'm running a little late. My son had a basketball game, so just wanted to call in and tell you some funny things about Chief. You know, and the thing about him that a lot of people don't understand is he was a very generous person. He's very tight, very generous, and I'll tell you a funny story. My wife and I went down to see him and Mary at the house before we had children. We were living in Covington. Of course, she lives in Griffin. So, and he's walking my wife through the house and all. So I'm always pulling something on him. I pull a nickel out and lay it over there on the dresser. And he walks over there, and I said to my wife, I said, Holly, I said, look at there. Look at that. She says, what is it? I said, that's the first nickel he ever made. Oh, he was about to get me, but you know what he did? He put it in his pocket. we were always pulling something on each other all the time. On the golf course, we played countless rounds of golf with him, and he was a very devoted husband and father and grandfather. And a lot of people, I'm 48 years old, and obviously I didn't get a chance to see him in his heyday before he became chief. And so when we got together and met, I didn't care who he was. We just became good friends. And, you know, you just cannot, I can't explain to you how many conversations we had about things that happened and things that he did over the years. You know, and I'd write these down, and he would laugh at me, and he said, you know, I told him, I said, one day when I get dementia, I'll look back and read this because you're never going to write a book. You know, so I remember talking about how cheap he is. I told Charlie Smith this story yesterday. We were at a golf course and found a golf club, and he didn't want it. I said, I'm going to take it up to the secondhand shop in Griffin and see what he'll give you for it. We walk in, and the guy says, I'll give you $15. Chief wanted $20. And he looked over at me and said, you'd think this guy's name was Lee Fields. And I said, well, that's better than George Gulis, because then he'd offer you $5. So Chief gets mad. We walk outside and get in the truck, and he said, go back in there and get $15. So I took the club and went in. The guy gave me $15. I put $5 with it, walked back outside. I said, he gave me $20 for this club. And I gave him the $15 and kept the $5, and to the day he died, he still took it. He thought I beat him out of $5. he was, I'm telling you guys, but he never spared a nickel with me. He was just so kind, and I'm going to miss him. I'm going to miss hearing his voice. He was the kind of person where if you thought enough of you, he gave you a nickname. And then if he thought even more of you, he called you by your given name. Like Tony Gurria is such a dear friend of his, and Tony was always Anthony. You know, and as the days went on, I was Tire Tom because I was in the wholesale tire business, and then I affectionately became Thomas. So y'all hadn't told any cheap stories on him tonight, have you?
No, because none of us actually got to know him. I mean, he was in New York by the time I got in the business. Gary was around him some, and Gary told a couple of things that he pulled up in Detroit. And Bobby worked in the ring with him as far as refereeing, but really didn't get to know him all that well. Because from what I understand, he was a very private person.
Oh, man. I got involved in wrestling in 87. Me and my friend Charles Bellflower started promoting shows for Jerry Blackwell and got to be around some phenomenal people. And that's where I met one of my future groomsmen, Ted Allen. And as years went on, I got to be around a lot of people and know a lot of people. And then Luke Graham was a very good friend of mine. And I told him I was going to Griffin. He said, you need to look up Chief. And then we just became buddies. And I'll tell you a funny story about Luke. Chief and them always call Luke Graham FOMO. And they were playing cards one night in Worcester, Mass. And Chief was sitting over there watching them, you know, and Luke was tooting on his bottle and all that stuff. And he laid the cards down. He said, I'll take FO and FOMO. And Gorilla popped up and had to win in hand. And Luke just stood up, flipped the table and all that. So from that point on, Luke was known as FOMO. So I'd hate to know the stuff that I didn't write down all those years that we rode up and down the road. You know, I remember him telling me about the DeMarco boxing match. I remember him telling me explicitly about being on vacation when Valentine broke his leg and he came down here and they ran the angle with him and Ernie Ladd. You know, that was just amazing. He tell you something funny. Well, before he came off the road as a road agent, they had a pay-per-view in Chattanooga. And me and my buddy Charles and Ted went up, and there were some other people, some marks that actually kind of followed us up there. The chief was going to leave me some passes at the door. Well, he got my last name messed up, and the guy finally let us in. The guy didn't act like he knew who Chief J. Strongbow was. Ted took his comp ticket that the guy had given us and walked up to the top. I went and found Chief, and Chief blessed that guy out, acting like he didn't know who he was. So we sat back there at the gorilla position, and I got to meet George Steele, Honky Tonk, Arnold Skolin, Vince. I mean, there were just so many people that, you know, he pulls me over to meet these people. And I felt privileged, and not that I was a wrestling person, but he was introducing me to his friends, and I'll never forget how he and Gino stood there and looked at that crowd at that arena, and they just said, you know, we could do this without smoke and mirrors and without music. And that really put it to me then, because they did it in the days when they didn't have the music and the smoke and the mirrors.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, that's funny.
And I miss those days.
It's, you know, the big funny thing was that Bret Hart loved Chief to death, and Bret and I used to have some funny conversations about him. You know, Bret was famous for drawing these cartoons on the wall at the shows and stuff like that, and in Chief's house is the original picture that's actually inside of Bret Hart's book of the giant mural of the wrestlers and Chief standing down at the bottom. And above that is a picture with Chief and Lou Fez in the ring and Dory Funk Jr. He thought Dory Funk was probably the best NWA champion they ever had as far as representing the belt and the organization.
Yeah.
And that, to me, that meant a lot because he spent a lot of time out there.
Yeah.
He and Carl Cox one time were in Texas. They stopped off at a driving range. And they're out there banging balls, and this little Latino kid walks up and says, what are y'all doing? And, you know, Chief said, we're betting money on who can hit that barrel out there at 50 feet. And the kid said, well, let me in on it. And Cox said, well, kid, you don't have any money. He said, the kid said, well, I work here at the driving range, and if y'all beat me, you can have all the free driving range balls you want every time you come by. Well, Chief was all over that, you know, wasn't going to cost him a nickel, so they get out there, and this kid shoots 10 balls, and about 9 of them hit the drum. Years later, it turned out to be Lee Trevino.
Oh, wow.
And he and Chief became good friends many years after that. In fact, Wahoo started playing with Trevino, and he called Chief on the phone. He'd say, Chief, he'd say, I beat him today. And Chief would say, well, how many times has he beat you? He's just stringing him along. And Chief said, quit playing with him. He's going to take every nickel you got. So.
Yeah, I heard that story.
Well, I'll tell you, I told Charlie yesterday, we went out the Noonan Road there out of Griffin headed towards Sonoma. And we had stopped at the Hong Kong Cafe there in Griffin and ate. And it was hot. And I said, don't fall asleep in this truck. I had a Dodge 1500 pickup the company had given me to drive. So don't go to sleep because I'll go to sleep. So the next thing you know, he's asleep over there snoring, sawing logs. Well, I pull off the side of the road to relieve myself. I go up in the edge of the woods, and I come back in the truck, and he is gone. So I head walking down the road, and about 10 minutes later, here he comes back up the road, no tires on the back of my truck. He'd done seen my customer and said, get in, and drove the rest of the way back. I'm telling you, I'd pull one on him and he'd get me back. We were playing golf in Thomaston one time with one of my customers who was a huge fan of his, and we got up on the green to putt out, and I found a hawk feather over there, and I stuck it in the back of my cap. And he kept always picking at me about being a ha-ha fella. Well, that got me a chop. And we got in the cart to go to the next tee box, and I just about turned the cart over because my chest is hurting. He asked me what's wrong with me, and I said, well, there's 750 pounds in the cart, and I'm not but 200 of it, so what do you expect? Well, that got me another chop. He used to have a Craftmatic adjustable bed in his little pro shop out there at the house, and if it were raining, we'd just sit in there and watch. We'd watch TV, and one day I went down there, and he was in there laid up in that bed, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm watching a Western." I said, "Anything unique happen?" He says, "Well, as always, the Indians are putting the Cowboys over." Now, Mike, I know that you're the historian of the group. Did you ever know of Chief ever having his head shaved?
It didn't happen in the Mobile territory. If it happened anywhere, it would have been, this sounds like a Tennessee angle to me. Are you talking about Estrompa or Escarpa?
Well, as him. We were sitting on the front porch of his house one day, and he pulls out this brown bag. I thought it was going to be another pistol or something he was going to try to sell me. And he said, "I want you to cut my hair." I said, "What do I look like, a barber?" And he said, "No, these are clippers." He said, "I want you to clip my head all the way down. And my hair's in my eyes. We're playing golf. It's just all over the place." So I plug him up, and he says, "You realize you're doing something somebody hadn't done in 30 years? Here I am grabbing his big old thick cauliflower ears, you know, and trying to shave his head." And he said, "Now take a picture of this." Now, that picture won't ever see anybody but me, but that's the kind of stuff that I won't ever forget. Those days and spending that time with him are the days that I cherish, and it had nothing to do with wrestling at all. Nothing.
Well, we were talking about Jerry, especially about how smart he was as far as the business and how, you know, how well he knew the business as far as the ins and outs and the psychology and everything.
Oh, Lord, yes.
I spent so much time on the road with after he retired from the ring. Did he ever share with you his thoughts on the direction of the business was going in under McMahon Jr.?
Well, he was there when Junior bought it on a shoestring. He told me that Vince Sr. used to walk around in terry cloth slippers. When Bret Hart started, he was going to be called Buddy the Heartthrob. And Chief told him, Chief said, you don't need to do that. It's not going to happen. And he used to call Bret Chief. I mean, Chief used to call Bret Stu all the time. Bret's second match with the WWF, I'll never forget him telling me this. He went out, had a great match. And he used a pile driver, and Chief came back. He came back to the back, and he said, "How'd it look?" He said, "Great. Don't use the pile driver ever again. It's Orndorff's," and paid him $50. And those days, they were running three towns a night. So he and Pat Patterson were basically running everything, and I believe at the time he said George Scott and Vince were up at the office. When George Scott left, Pat kind of got the nod as the booker there. And I don't think Chief ever felt slighted, but I think Chief kind of felt like he probably could have done that job. You know, because Senior was so easy to work for, and Junior was too. And he always called Junior to the boys the Emperor. The Emperor wants this. The Emperor wants that. But when he referred to him to anybody else, he was just Junior. But I never heard him say one negative thing about Junior the whole time. And see, with me, he didn't have to worry about what he said to me. It wasn't like I was in the same circle of those people to repeat it. So he could be as honest with me as he wanted to be. He loved Gino to death. I'll never forget the day Gino died. He called me that night. We talked. And then the next morning he called me and he got off the phone with Blassie. He and Blassie were very dear friends. And I think Chief and Blassie and Gorilla and Monsoon were just three peas in a pod there. I mean, they were so close. And in those days, you had to be.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of that.
I was just wondering how he thought of people like Hogan and stuff like that that totally changed the business from, you know,
well,
the way
he
protected back in our day to it being so wide open.
Well, he was extremely private, and he guarded the business to his last day, I'm sure. But Hogan, you know, he went up to Hogan one time, and he said, you know, we were standing there talking to him, and, you know, he looked at me, and he said, "Hogan, he really believes this. He really believes it. He believes that he's become this persona." He knew Hogan didn't know the difference in a wrist lock and a wrist watch, but he admired him because he knew how to make money. Same thing about Lex Luger. Lex Luger was horrible, but he says he knows how to make money. and you always make your own deal in wrestling. He says, you always make your own deal. And he looked at people about the money that they drew. He thought the world of Fez. He thought the world of Funk, of Brisk, because they had it in the ring, and they earned their money, and that's how he didn't like the new form of the business. Now, I'll never forget, we were at the Georgia Dome one time, went to a WCW show, and Bill Goldberg comes down the ring, and he looks over to me, and he said, who's this guy? So he had just really, if you weren't somewhat legitimate, he didn't care anything about you. You know, it's just the way it was. He loved Dynamite Kid, Tom Bellick. He loved him to death. And then Dynamite started, they started pulling those ribs and doing just crappy things and not doing things. And then I think he told me they were in England one time and went to visit him. He was living in a flat, living in a slum hole. He didn't feel sorry for him because he kind of did it to himself, you know. But he was very protective of the business, and he gave a lot of guys a lot of business. I'll never forget, he used to say, oh, that Snake Roberts, oh, he made a lot of money. Made a lot of money. And that's all he would say. He knew he had a good work ethic. He knew his dad. He knew what a tumultuous life he had had, but he just kind of peed it away. But all he ever used to say is he made a lot of money. He thought a lot of Jimmy Garvin. You know, he was very instrumental with Jimmy. Thought a lot of Don Curtis. He used to call Don's brother Spider. He thought a lot of Al Galento, Fred Ward. I mean, I could go down a list of people that he thought so much of.
Yeah, no, he was close to, I don't know how close he was to Leanfield, but he was pretty close to Bobby and Don Field. In fact, he lived on originally in the late 50s belonged to Buddy Fuller, but the Fields brothers, when they bought the Mobile territory, they were actually buying Buddy Fuller's ranch in Locksley, Alabama, and Buddy just kind of threw the territory, the rest of the promotion in as a side deal. But Bobby Fields was known in Tennessee, Bobby Fields, Don Fields, and Scarborough all lived there on the ranch.
Right.
We were talking about before you got on the air was every territory he went after the Mobile territory, he was billed a thing from Mobile, Alabama.
Yep.
And which is an odd place to pick and be billed from, unless you're really from there.
Well, and I can't remember my timeline right of when he told me, but when he bought the place down in Griffin, that had a big influence because Buddy Fuller owned a place not far outside of Locust Grove. And I think he had some horses and stuff like that. And Chief didn't get into. He had a couple of horses, and he had more cows. But that probably rubbed off on him a little bit. But he was never more happy. I remember riding down through that pasture and looking at that old pond, and he was just at home. He just loved being down there. He knew how to do a lot of stuff, fix fences. He could lay brick. I mean, he could do so many things that people would never have a clue of what he could do. He had very humble beginnings and came from absolutely nothing. And to attain what he did and was able to keep it, when we were out in Griffin eating lunch or something somewhere, he was very well respected. People didn't bother him. Of course, he'd been there forever. Now, I had a customer down there that I was trying to get in their front door, and they were very hard people to try to deal with. And I'd mentioned it to Chief, and Chief said, well, when you pick me up tomorrow, we'll go play golf. I've got an errand we need to run. So we went, ate lunch, played golf, and we went to the tire store that I was trying to do business. It was Willis Tire and Auto. And he walked in, and he went to Kim Willis, and he said, Kim, how long have I been doing business here? He said, Chief, you've been here forever. And he said, I won't spend another dime of my money with you until you start doing business with him. And he said, he's not going to benefit me, but he's going to benefit you. So you talk about being put over. He carried, and let me tell you that Kim Willis and I became very good friends, and that was a very good relationship. But I kind of felt like he with Gino, because Gino opened the door for him to go to New York. Gino opened that door when Vince was looking for an Indian gimmick. Chief took the call. And, you know, I think you guys were going to talk about tonight people that had not made their gimmicks. You know, I've had people say, oh, he's Italian. How can he do that? I said, well, look at here. Look at Barry Darsaw. He was a Russian. Look at Red McNulty. He was Canadian. He acted like he was a Russian. look at Boris Malenko, whose real name was Simon. They were Jewish, and he was acting like a Nazi German. Anybody, including me, would have taken the same opportunity that he would have. Matt Bourne went up there and became a clown.
Well, the thing was, back in our day, and more so Bobby and Dan, they go a little bit further back than I do, but that's how you made your gimmick. I mean, you pretty much took on that persona, and I don't mean taking it to the extreme with the Sheik did, wearing his vermouth all around and you know, out in public and acting like that, but you bought into the gimmick because, like Ole Anderson used to say, if you don't believe in yourself, how do you expect the audience to believe?
Let me tell you, I've seen every pair of cowboy boots. He's got every pair of jeans. He gave me a belt buckle. I have it to this day. That was made by Nikita Malkovich. And at the time, I believe Nikita was making all the straps in New York.
Okay, well,
and it's got an Indian head on one side, a buffalo on the other, and it's got his initials, JS, on it. I have every single pair of tights he ever wore. I have one of his headdresses. I have a charcoal drawing that Anthony White did for him. And everybody knows who Anthony White is. Tony Atlas. You could not give me all the gold in Fort Knox for that, because I know the love that went in it from Tony to give to Chief and then Chief to give to me. And that is, he was his gimmick. He had a little bit of Indian heritage in his blood, but you didn't see him in a three-piece suit and then him on TV talking like an Indian. You know, you went to his house, you went in his den down there, and it looked like something out of Gunsmoke. He liked that cowboy Indian type of a persona. They were in a little sharpshooting club there in Griffin forever, and he took a name after me. He was known as Badass Tom. He was a cowboy on a quick draw team. How does he go from an Indian to a cowboy on a quick draw team?
The all-time champion of gimmicks was Don Fargo.
No, oh, Lord.
He did. I mean, when he became Jack Dalton in the early 60s, he learned to draw. Now, here's somebody who grew up in Hell's Kitchen, New York, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the coal mines. He's all of a sudden a cowboy, and he's, you know, he took it to the extreme. He learned how to quick draw, and he held some fast draw records. And Nick Kozak, the quick draw artist, for several years in around the Dallas territory, and then as the Dalton image kind of the cowboy image faded away, he and Frank Dalton became the original version of Al Bale, and they started wearing the motorcycle. Of course, they ran around the motorcycle.
Well, I'll tell you this: Jerry Oates' name came up one day. We were playing golf, and I've never met Jerry, but I have seen Jerry when he would wrestle for Jerry Blackwell, and they would tape at Miss Kitty's up there. And I've got on tape, and you and Michael, and you know, I've kind of emailed back about this, his match with Austin Idol. Chief had a lot of respect for Jerry Oates, I'm going to tell you, and his brother also. And I'm not saying it because he's listening. I'm saying it because he knew that. He believed that because he knew that Jerry was taught the proper way and that he was a good representative of the business while he was in the business. And I've heard y'all make the comment, Bobby make the comment about Geigel, what he said about Oates. That's what your legacy is. That's the shadow that you cast. That's humility. And when you leave this earth, you go back and you look at what you left behind. And all these people that did good things and worked hard and paid their dues, they'll be remembered for that.
Well, those kind words coming from Joe means a lot, I'll tell you. Because I respected him, and I really thought the world of him, and that makes me feel proud that he would say something like that.
Well, we were laughing. They put some linoleum down in his kitchen. We came home, we're looking, and there wasn't a stitch of furniture in that kitchen. So I started grabbing some table chairs, and he says, "Oh, wait a minute, I want to show you a couple of holes here." So I oh no, what am I fixing to get strung into? Now I'm 6'5", 265 pounds. Let me tell you, he handled me like a twisty tie off of a bread wrapper. And I had worked a little bit in the ring, but nothing like him, of course. But He said, let me show you this. Let me show you this. And the next thing you know, I was I could taste that new linoleum floor. And he said, this is what we used to do in Texas. He said, we'd go back after the matches, and he said, we'd wrestle all over the house. See who could get the best of who. I don't know that I could have made it in them days for those guys. He showed me the sugar hole. I mean, he showed me, oh, my gosh. And I remember coming home and calling Ted on the phone and telling him, he said, you were shooting with Strongbow in the kitchen of his house. I said, I don't look at it that way. I said, he was stretching me. And, anytime he said, come here, I want to show you something, I never said no. I never said no because he taught me a lot of stuff, you know. But he was good. He was smooth. Oh, man, he was smooth. I got the knee brace that he used in the Spectrum matches against Greg Valentine, you know, where he pulled a piece of metal out, you know, to go after Val. I've got that brace. He's going to throw it in the trash. You know, I've got two posters. Mike, you've seen them. He's gave me two posters from Japan and one from Madison Square Garden. They were done on rice paper. And, Mike, you helped me identify some of the people on there, you know, but that's the stuff of yesteryear, man. Those, you don't see stuff like that anymore.
Tom, this is getting away from the Chief story, but tell and I was telling them a little bit about this before you called in. Tell them about all the people that attended your wedding, that you found their name on your wedding book.
Oh, my Lord. Let me tell you. I could talk for days about Ted Allen. I love him, and let me tell you, he and Karen hadn't been seeing each other long. Came to our house. That's the last time my kids got to see him and all. But anyway, Ted was a groomsman in my wedding, and we had a big, big fancy wedding. We had 600 people at the church, and, you know, he did the Fargo Street. Wouldn't try on his shoes the day before. He ended up wearing black cowboy boots. I got cussed out for that. He did the Fargo Struck going out of the church. Got cussed out for that. So we get over to the country club, and they got a registry, you know, where you sign in. Here we are, here you were at the so-and-so. Well, during about 2 months after that, I'm looking through that book with some friends of mine in my neighborhood, and they knew I knew some wrestlers and all, and they said, Harley Race was at your wedding? I said, what? Yeah, I got Richard Morgan Fleer was at your wedding. Who is that? I said, and I thought they were ribbing me. I thought they were just aggravating me. I said, Luthez? Thomas Richardson? I was like, what in the devil? And what Ted was doing, about every 5 minutes, he'd let somebody, and then he'd go in and sign a name. And then a few minutes later, he'd come in and sign another one. The last name on there is King Kong Bundy. So I said, you rascal.
I'm trying to figure out how he got his hands on a tux, because I know he didn't spring to rent one.
Let me tell you what. I'll tell you this. Anytime I was around Ted Allen, he never spent a nickel with me. Never. I never let him buy a meal. I never let him buy gas. If we had to spend the night somewhere, he didn't pay a dime. And I was glad
he wasn't going to pay a dime.
Well,
I told him when we went on tonight, I said, the Chief made Ted look like a big spender.
Ooh, Ted, let me tell you what. Ted was Trump. Ted was Trump. And when I called Ted and told him about the tuxedo, and he says, well, Tom, said, how much do those tuxedos run? I said, hey, about $140, Ted. Okay. Well, that's all right. He said, how much is a hotel room? I said, oh, I got y'all at a big place down here in Athens. I said, well, it's going to cost you about $240. Well, let me see if I'm booked that weekend. I said, you ain't booked nowhere. And I said, you ain't going to have to pay a dime for nothing while you're here. And I said, if I see you spending any money, I'll never speak to you again. He went with me on a trip with my buddies and some other people down to Florida a week before we got married. My wife was a daggum man. I thought he pulled a trick on me. We got down the road and eating Slim Jims and drinking beer or something, and he put his daggum hood on his head. And we're riding down the road, and he's got the nightmare hood on. We're pulling down the road, and State Florida's Highway Patrol pulls us over, and he said, why is that man wearing a mask? I said, he's a professional wrestler. And he said, are you on your way to a match? And Ted said, yes, I am. Where are you going? Said, St. George, Florida. And the guy said, have a nice day. We go down there and we pull in a liquor store in Tallahassee, and he goes in with his hood on. He didn't even think about it. Walked through the store, put stuff in the buggy, we paid and left, and he got in the car and he said, "Damn, I had my hood on." And I said, "Well, Ted, they probably thought you were touched." I said, "You know, you're kind of built that way anyway, and your head's kind of flat on the backside, you know." So let me tell you, I love him. I miss him. And Bobby singing at his funeral. I was sitting on the second row there behind Randall Brown, and I miss him so much. And let me tell you, when he was around Chief admired him a lot too. And they would talk about some things. And I had a hip replaced last year about this time, and they called me from Charlotte 2 weeks before Ted passed away. He and Chief both called me and chit-chatted with me on the phone. And then I had to call Chief 2 weeks later and tell him that Ted passed away. And he said to me, he says, "I know you. He was one of your best friends." And he said, "But I admired him and respected him." That meant a lot to me for Ted.
I don't think there was anybody in the business that didn't. Ted was just, I've said this several times, I've never met anybody that loved the business more than me. Just absolutely loved it.
We used to go eat lunch, and the waitress would come over, and Ted would be some, you know, at the buffet or whatever. You know, we're always at buffets. I'd say, "You know, that guy sitting with me is a famous wrestler." And I said, "His twin brother was a famous wrestler, too." She said, "Really, who?" I said, "He is the twin brother of Sky Lolo." And she'd come back, and she came over with a pen. She said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Ted." She said, "I want your autograph, but I'm going to give you an address, and I want you to get your famous brother, twin brother, to give me his autograph, too." And she said, "He said, who is that?" She said, "Sky Lolo." Oh, he was mad, boy. I used to aggravate him because me and him looked like Mutt and Jeff walking anyway. But he loved Chief. Me and him, and let me tell you what, me and him, and he wanted to pull a rib on Chief, but he didn't want to take the heat for it. Chief had an 84 model Dodge pickup truck. It was silver. He just had the air conditioning fixed in it, and it burned gas like you wouldn't believe. And Chief would really have a fit now if he had to put gas in the car. But we went up to the parts store to get a gas cap for it there in Griffin. Me and him and Ted get up in the front seat of this Dodge, and we get up there. Well, I'd brought Chief's extra set of keys with me. I was going to move his truck. Chief said, "Y'all stay in the truck, I'll go inside." Well, the next thing you know, we hop out, lock it, running with the keys in it. We come inside. He says, "What are y'all doing in here?" And I said, "I had to use the bathroom." Ted had to use the bathroom. We go back out in the car, and the truck's running. AC just running. He says, "Oh, my God. Oh, Lord, I don't have my extra keys, Mary. It's not at home. What am I going to do? What am I going to do?" I said, "It's a long way back." I said, "I guess we're just going to have to bust the window out." No, that would cost $100 to get it. Everything cost. I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And then Ted said, "Well, I can go over here. I knew it. I've learned a trick when I was on the road." He went over there, and he had the key, and he was bumping the door, and he unlocked the door, went in. Chief's eyes got big as a saw. "Oh, man, you don't know how much money you just saved me and all." We're getting in the truck. We're riding back. I made Ted sit in the middle because I was going to throw him under the bus. But when I smartened Chief up what he did, Ted got chopped that time. But it was hot. It was July or August. And the funniest thing about it is Chief sitting there worried about, "Oh, I'm just wasting gas, wasting money. We're just blowing out the back, blowing out the back. Money's just going up down the road." I'm telling you, man, he was something else. He was something else. And I remember we were going up 75 one time, and we came up through Locust Grove, and we pulled up next to Abdullah. He was in one of his vans. And we pulled up next to him and honked the horn, and next thing you know, Abdullah didn't know who it was. At first, he points a pistol out the window. He said, "I told you that SOB was crazy. Get the hell out of here." I said, "This is on the side he's going to shoot," or something like that. But he stayed in contact with a lot of people. You know, we went to we were sitting at the kitchen table one time, and the phone rang. He said, "Get that, see who it is," you know. And I said, "Hello." And he said, "This is Adam Sandler. Is the chief there?" Well, I figured somebody was pulling a rib. And it wasn't. It was actually Adam Sandler wanting an autographed picture of him because it hadn't been long after that movie Big Daddy had been made. And I don't know if y'all have seen the movie or not, but the little boy spending time with Adam Sandler, and he says, "Well, what did he teach you?" And he said, "He taught me how to do the sleeper hold like Chief J. Strongbow in a movie." So he gave me his information, and he was good friends with Jay Leno. He knew Jack Nicklaus. He touched a lot of people. He really did.
Well, speaking of touching people, I've got another caller in here that has touched all of us at one time or another. Let me get him on the line with us. Mr. Smythe.
Hello.
Charlie, I need to come get that lawnmower.
Charlie.
Yeah.
You got your hearing aids in?
No, I don't have it in. I've been listening for them. I thought it was great.
No, I'm going to put you over tonight. Put you on the air.
Ask Charlie to tell you the story about Chief and the boxer dog.
Yeah, you know, down in Mobile, Joe had this kitten dog, the boxer. And he was going, him and Mary were going back to New Jersey. That's where he met Mary at, and I watched it here. Then he was washing clothes, and she's wearing too. And they got talking there. And I guess they fell in love right there at the laundromat. And so he said he'd get married, and he wanted to get rid of the dog. And he knew I lived out in the country, and wanted to know if I would take care of it. I said, yeah. And I kept that dog for about 20 years. My kids were, and the dogs were always together. That dog loved my kids better than they did anything. And Joe, every time Joe come by, he come by my house. And he'd see the dog. He couldn't believe it, still here.
Is that the one that didn't have any teeth, Charlie?
My pardon?
Is that the one that didn't have any teeth?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no teeth. He killed his mommy to death. Yeah, you know, Mike, you know, you mentioned a while ago about Joe being the rebel. He wrestled as a rebel here, too, you know.
Yeah, that's what I asked. Jordan, the main territory he used in it was the rebel.
Did he wrestle down in Mobile as a rebel?
No, they built him as being from Los Angeles when he was in Mobile. Tom, I don't know. Do you have a picture of him with the Gulf Coast belt? If not, I'll send you one.
What, Mike?
What's that?
Say it again, Mike.
I said, do you have a picture of him wearing the Gulf Coast belt?
Are you asking me or Charlie?
No, I'm asking you, Tom.
No, I do not. And I remember something. You know, I had wrote down that he was, I think in 1969, wasn't he the first Georgia TV champion? He wrestled Bolo and Assassin and DeMarco or something. He was telling me something about that. He said he was a long night. Where would that have been? Would that have been in Atlanta? Or
yeah, they used to do some one-night tournaments where the guys would work two or three times.
And Bobby, I can't remember if I heard you tell part of this story or whatever, but what was the deal with Blassie and the Cadillac, and Little Beaver bought a Cadillac just like
his?
Oh,
that was Little Eagle, Chief Little Eagle.
And they spent the top off of it or something.
Yeah, Little Eagle was booking here, and him and Blassie, they had some actual heat between them. They didn't really like each other. And Charlie was around when this happened, and I think I heard the story from Charlie, but they... Little Eagle bought a Cadillac, and Blassie went and bought a Cadillac the same week, and they bought identical Cadillacs, and neither one knew it. And they found out about it at Atlanta TV, and Blassie went on TV, and they were going to Hoganville that night, and Blassie got on TV and told him, he said, "All you pencil neck geeks in Hoganville, I'm driving my brand new Cadillac down there tonight, and I don't want none of y'all to lay a hand on it." And then Blassie caught a ride with somebody and went down there, and Little Eagle drove his Cadillac down there, and they cut the tire slap off of it.
Yeah, after Gorilla died, him, Brett Blatt, he called me, he was late, said, "Me and Freddie been laughing, I almost wet myself." And he was telling me that story, and he said he couldn't hardly tell me because he was laughing so hard, and I knew that one time that you had either told the story or heard the story or something that. But, Mike, I was going to tell you something kind of interesting. A lot of people don't realize he had a lot of stroke back in the days when he became a road agent. And at the first WrestleMania, Dr. D. David Schultz was kind of on the back. He was kind of in the doghouse. And he always felt like Roddy Piper, he should have Roddy Piper's position in that main event with Mr. T. So they were in Los Angeles, and David Schultz had done showed up, and Chief Dunn told him, you're not on the card, you're off the card, you know, you're done, you can stay here. If you cause any trouble, we'll handcuff you and take you to the airport. Well, Schultz is walking around telling everybody, you know, T's sitting at the ringside over there, I'm going to jump him and whoop his tail. Vince has got to put me in the main event at WrestleMania. He's got to do it. So this gets back to Vince, and Vince lures him in the office. He goes in there screaming and hollering. They come in there to get him, and he runs down the hall, and Chief said, I've never seen a redneck that big carry a TV monitor and throw it at me so hard in my whole life. And he said, he came directly after me, and he said they immediately handcuffed him and took him to the Los Angeles airport. And not long after that is when the situation with Stossel happened. So he was involved with a lot of intricacies back in the early days before this thing started to snowball. He had some great sayings. You know, one of the ones he used to tell, he told Bret Hart this. He said, you know, he says, in this business, you can make money or make friends. Make your money and then choose your friends. And he told me, he said, everything is subject to change. Everything. And you know, you think about it, it does.
Yes, it does.
And if I look at it this way, if I had been considered an acquaintance of his, that'd been all right with me. But to be called one of his friends, that's something that I don't know that I'll ever have another friend, him or Ted. And my buddy Charles, you know, those three guys are my three buddies, man. They're my three buddies. They're my friends.
Let me tell you all about Bill Scarper and Don Curtis. We were coming back from Augusta. We always stop at this little place, beer joint, outside of Augusta, because I-20 wasn't built. So we go in there and we sit down, eating, drinking a beer. And this one guy was talking about him. I said, funny ass wrestlers. I whoop all of them and everything. Joe tells the guy, be quiet, you know. And, you know, he wouldn't do it. Give it up. So finally said, I whoop everybody. Don Curtis got up. Went over there where the guy was sitting, took his hot dog, and rubbed it all in his face. He had mustard ketchup all over his face and a hot dog, and he sat back down. And the guy started to get a napkin to wipe it off. He said, you wipe it off, I'm whooping your butt all over this place. And the guy set the napkin back down. Here we got through, we left. I was scared of that. I thought dogs are killing. You know, they were protected about the business in them days. They didn't want to take no crap from nobody.
Chief told me him and Ramey were shooting. Chief said he and Ramey were shooting pool somewhere in Mobile. It was a biker bar, and he said, I don't even know how we ended up in there, but we're shooting a few games of pool, and more bikers are coming in. He said, I'm trying to tell Raymond, let's get out of here. He said, a couple more games, and he gets these two bikers over there and shooting pool, and he asked Ramey a question. He said, oh, they call me Ramey from Atlanta. Chief said, we're getting the hell out of here because we picked a kid. He said, I can't take them all on, Ken, and you ain't going to do nothing to them. So I'd hate to know what that pool hall looked like in Mobile, Alabama, with a bunch of bikers in there. I'll tell you this, we were playing golf one time, and number 9 hole is Griffin is across the water, and it was Chief's favorite hole. He could shut his eyes and hit the ball, and it'd land on the green. And he was always clipping us for, you know, we'd play for a nickel and dime and a quarter and stuff. So I told his buddies, I said, I'm going to get him today. He's not going to get us. So he shoots the ball, lands on the green. I said, I'll bet you $20 you can't do that again. So he's over there giving the money to a guy we're playing with, and I went over and put one of those talcum powder golf balls on the ground. I laid it on the ground. And he lines up over there, got down like a sumo wrestler like he used to hit the ball. And I stopped. I said, you sure you want to take this bet? I said, because I'm going to take that $20. Oh, Thomas, I got this, Thomas. He hit that ball and it exploded. We all hit the ground and laughing and laughing. Well, I got chopped again. That man had the biggest hand. He had sausage for fingers. But he had the softest hands, and I know that anybody that ever worked with that man in the ring, he had to be smooth. Was he smooth, Bobby?
Oh, it was a day off. I told a story with him. He hit me with a garbage can one night. And it was one of those big metal aluminum cans, you know. And, of course, all it does is cave in. But, I mean, you know, you didn't know he was there. You did not know he was there. I would like to have been in the ring with him. When I first saw him, I was just a kid. I was going to the matches here in Atlanta, and I was telling the guys before you came on, the big deal back then was the big feud was him and Stan Stasiak.
Oh, yeah.
And just the fire and the passion he had. I would like to have been in the ring with him in those days, because I'm sure his work habits changed over the years. And when he was the chief, man, he was just, you know, it's like the old thing you see going around, how do you know you're an old timer and the first thing on the list is you don't want to get hurt? Chief had gotten to that point where he wanted to go out and do his deal. He knew how to do it without getting hurt, and that's what he wanted to do.
In his early 40s, he told me about them wrestling, you know, and he would show me tapes. He says, watch me bring Mulligan in the ring. And they would, you know, they'd be in the ring, and then Mulligan's on the outside. So he goes over and does a flying head scissors as he runs. He puts his hands on the top rope and pulls him in with his legs.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a heck of a bump for Mulligan to try to pull over, because we know how that works. But the daggum ropes in those days were ropes. I mean, Lord have mercy, it looked like a bungee cord.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the kind of, and the baseball slide, he said so many people tried to do that and they'd break their ankle.
Yep.
He said the trick to it to him was the moccasins. The moccasins helped him out a lot with that.
Yeah.
And doing that slide. And, you know, for him to hit those ropes and do what he did, he just must have been hell on wheels in his days. Because I don't have any footage of him wrestling in, like at Homer Hesterly and Mobile and all those. There's none of it around, I don't guess.
Yeah, it'd be hard to find.
I know he gave me a clip of him and DeMarco. One thing that was kind of neat, when they would go to Philadelphia and places like this, this was when he was a road agent, people would bring these, what were they, 7mm or 8mm cameras to the house shows.
Yeah.
You'd wind them up and it'd take a few. Well, they would confiscate all of that film or those cameras. And they would go back and they would put them on one. I bet I have a half a dozen of those. I've got a match. That somebody confiscated when he was in a world championship match with Billy Graham. No sound. This looks like a home movie.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life. You know, and then.
I was going to say we're winding down a little bit, but I got one more caller I want to get on the air with us. So let me get this person on the air with us. Calling from Atlanta. You're on air. Go ahead. Oh. Well, goodbye. Never mind. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, guys, I want to tell you, I appreciate the opportunity to, you know, I've talked a lot about him, and I haven't even touched the surface on him, but I want to thank you guys for what you do on the air and what you do for people that understand the business, and there's some people that just don't. You know, I enjoy hearing Bo James. I enjoyed your deal with Bill Dundee. I liked it when Dickie called. Anytime Jerry Oates is talking, that is the most unbelievable. I just love hearing it. I love hearing about Sockeye Billy and the T-shirts.
Oh, you had to bring that up, didn't you?
Let me tell you, you know how you could have made some money? You'd have... You could have got Chief to sell those T-shirts for you. You'd probably made some money on them.
We would have. I should have had him as an agent selling my shirts.
But he, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. And Bobby, you know how much I respect you and Charlie and Michael. I'm hoping to meet you one day. But you guys, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for keeping us folks that, that like the old days alive and talking about people that we know about.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you calling
Thank
in.
Thank you, Tom.
In.
Well, guys, we've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to go ahead and talk about our guests we're going to have with us next week. We're going to have actually two special guests with us. Two generations of Tennessee and North Georgia wrestlers, Gene LaBelle and Jimmy Paul are going to join us next week. Week after that, we're actually going to take the week off because I don't have the circus in town, and Bobby will be just getting back from spending a week out in Las Vegas with Charlie, and he'll probably need a full week to recover from that. So,
I'm easy.
He's not cheap, but he's reasonable. Who'd you say we're going to have next week? Gene LaBelle and who?
Jimmy Powell.
Jimmy Powell.
Reverend Powell.
You know,
Ted Allen stories.
You know that Gene LaBelle, man, I ain't real sure you can believe a whole lot he says. He has a Burrhead Bennett persona that, you know, he...
And then they Burrhead.
Yeah, Burrhead Bennett, yeah. Yeah, and you know, he's going to, Debbie just reminded me of something. You know, Charlie, he'll be all geared up next Thursday night because he'll be still receiving come next Saturday.
Yeah. I thought
we
had a T-shirt.
We'll appreciate this, Charlie. Next week's show is going to be sponsored by Renegade T-shirts.
Renegade T-shirt got me rabid talking. All right.
How's Bill Dromo doing? Because I know Chief thought a lot of him.
Bill is Bill's just holding his own. The Parkinson's is progressing right along, and he's as gruff as he's ever been. He's just.
I remember seeing him at Ted's funeral and telling Chief I got to see him and all. And he always liked Bill.
Yeah, Bill's super guy. Super guy.
There's somebody, a friend named George Shire, who was on the show with us a couple of weeks ago, posted a picture on Facebook, either today or yesterday, of Joe Romo and Doug Gilbert as the professional all in the ring together. I guess it was a six-man tag match. So I'm thinking
wow.
All the talent in this ring.
Wow. Those guys forgot more about that business than these guys now ever know.
Oh, tell me about it.
Most amazing thing about that picture.
By the time I was sitting there, picture of us down in Conyers, Georgia, at the wrestling match there.
Oh,
I want to see that.
I saw that the other day. Is that the one with Bill McMahon and us?
Yeah.
Yes, I got it too.
I sent it to both y'all. Charlie don't ever check his mail.
Yeah, well, he...
Oh, yes, I do. I'm wondering.
He knows where the on and off button is.
Hey, Bobby, tell me about... Chief always told me Homer Odell always carried a bunch of guns, and you said you had a story about Homer and the pistol. Do you got time to tell me real fast?
Well, it's not a story of Homer and the pistol. It's just a story. It's a story with Homer in Athens. Him and Jody Hamilton rode together. Jody drove, and they had a mark jump in the ring in Athens. And Homer, of course, nailed the guy a couple of times, and the guy out on the floor, and the cops threw him out of the building. Well, that night when they got ready to leave, Jody told Homer, he said, I know where we can stop at this package store. He said, you walk up to the drive-in window, and he said, you don't have to go in. He said, you don't have to fool with the fans. He said, the guy will wait on you through the window. So Jody parked, sitting there with the mask on, they parked behind the building. Homer gets out and walks over to the window. And Jody said the window went up, and he said all he saw was a fist come out that window. And he hit Homer right in the nose. It was a guy that jumped in the ring. That was the time. He said the window went back down. That was the end of it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he used to tell me stuff about Homer. Homer always had a gun. Always had guns.
Guys, we are right down to the wire. Everybody be safe as you travel. And Tom, again, I appreciate you joining us. Jerry, I appreciate you joining us. And we will do this again next week, guys.
All right, guys. Thank good you. Night. See y'all next
Thursday.
Good night, everybody.
All right.
Night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast.
production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.